Life expectancy content is for informational and storytelling purposes only. We are not medical professionals, and nothing discussed in this episode or contained on the life expectancy website should be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you're facing medical concerns, addiction, or any health-related challenges, please seek guidance from a qualified medical professional or a licensed healthcare provider. Thank you for being a part of our journey, and we encourage you to seek support from trusted professionals when needed. Welcome back. This is Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving, a podcast about hardships and sistership. So, Stacey, what's new this week?
It's a bit of an introspective week, actually. I woke up a couple days ago and someone that I viewed as a peer, she's a celebrity, she passed away. And, you know, it's so weird because she was in some of my favorite shows growing up. She was probably about 6 years younger than me, but still, like, I watched her on teen dramas that I loved and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And she passed away almost a year ago. She had a liver transplant. Mm. And although they're not saying exactly the details of her passing, they are hinting that it could have to do with complications of a liver rejection.
Yeah.
And having been a transplant recipient, this is something that always plays on my mind, and it just came out of left field. I didn't expect it. And she's younger than me, and it just hit home because I know that I am all about life and living it to the fullest and not wasting time, because time, that four-letter word, is so important to me, because this transplant, it's not a cure. It's like a tight ACE bandage, especially with my genetic condition, but even just regular transplants. It's treating the symptom, but we're never going to cure it. So I'm very conscious of time, and just hearing about her passing just put me in a very thoughtful kind of mood most of the week.
Well, and what's interesting about this is a couple days ago, a friend of mine mentioned to me that, oh, this person passed away. And I was surprised, right, because of her age. And then you and I got to talking, and it wasn't until right before this podcast recording that we talked about why potentially it might be. And so I looked up some of the pictures. And the very first thing that I noticed when I looked at some of the pictures of her in the last year was I instantly recognized that it's very clear to me anyway, looking at her, that she was going through something very similar to what you have gone through.
I took so many pictures documenting my journey. One, because honestly, I didn't think I was going to make it. And two, just because I've always been a kind of person that documents things like that. Like when I'm doing a home improvement project, or these are the kind of things I think about. And I think I was almost like textbook in my face. You could see the changing of the color, my eyes, the swelling, the
being
puffiness.
Jaundice, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the ascites, which is just the retaining of all the liquid that happens.
Oh, God.
You know, it's funny, too. I was of two minds when you were taking pictures at the time. You know, I was there, right? So I was seeing you do some of that, not all of that. And I wasn't sure how I felt about it. But now I'm really happy because every once in a while, you'll send me something on your time hop and it'll take me back there and we can share with our community.
Yeah,
on
for sure.
I on have the website. We'll have the timeline there and there'll be some poignant photos around some of the things that we're talking about.
And like some of the procedures I did, some of the harder ones, the things I went through, and I was just very conscious of the way that I looked and the changes. And some of my most favorite pictures of myself are within the weeks after my transplant, because my eyes are so bright and they're so clear and the yellow's gone.
Yeah.
And the yellow built up so much over time because my liver wasn't processing things that I didn't even really notice how bad it was until it was that bad.
About the picture thing real quick too, I was thinking there was one event that I'm sure we'll talk about that she was in the hospital and it was she likely wasn't going to make it. And it was one of those nights where it was pretty rough. And for whatever reason, and I don't know what compelled me to do it, and I don't think I ever sent it to you, I actually took a picture of you that night while you were in the ER before they
got you. Both
you
and Ryan took pictures. I have those two pictures. They are, to me, very disturbing. But it doesn't look like me.
But the reason why I think I did it was because it's this idea that that was maybe the last time that you were going to be really here.
I was hooked up to so many different machines.
Yeah. And that was a rough night.
But I do. I look at those pictures. And it's another thing that fuels me, that keeps me going, to see how far I've come, mm-hmm. how far I'd fallen, and to never fall into that again. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure I don't.
So the pictures are, for me, when you send them to me, they're maybe less therapeutic, and they actually... This is going to sound odd, but they kind of come with love. It's almost like a like a little gift that you're saying, like, hey, I don't want to forget this. But
it's interesting.
I don't want you to forget it either, but look where we are now. But I can see how for you, it would be more a deterrent and a reminder.
I own all the mistakes that I made. And trust me, I suffered for it. And I think that these pictures just keep it fresh in my mind to just make sure I'm never going to make those same mistakes again.
It shouldn't take a celebrity for people to know this. Like, so more and more, technology is getting better. Medicine's getting better. So organ transplants are becoming more and more attainable. They're still very hard. You still have to get on the UNOS list. You still have to go through a lot of things. And not everybody is eligible, and not everybody should be. And there's supply and demand issues and
sure.
insurance and money and all these things
Lots
that go
factors.
Into it. Yeah, a lot of factors, a lot of variables. But it is becoming more and more doable. It's happening at a higher rate. And so I think it's interesting because when you talk about celebrities, usually you don't hear about these kind of things. And so maybe there's an opportunity here by you bringing this up and by people hearing about it. You know, organ donation is something that's hard to talk about, but has saved so many lives. But if a person does pass away, even if that's their wishes, their family sometimes don't honor them, or you're not really in a condition that everything can be used. So it is such a gift.
For sure, yeah.
But it's hard. You know, it doesn't come without consequence.
In my experience, it's the kind of situation where when I am, like, I go to the gym 3 times a week. My gym is in the hospital. It started out as physical therapy, and now I just keep going because I'm getting stronger and my endurance. But I am surrounded by people with health issues. It's either cardiovascular, pulmonary. We're all in there for something. We joke about, you know, what are you in for? Mm-hmm. Not a lot of transplant. It's me and one other guy who's in my, you know, my session. And when I tell people that I'm transplant, they're surprised. It's not common, but it's not rare anymore. But it's just not really talked about. Like, yeah. I was kind of surprised when I heard that she had had a liver transplant. And they specifically said liver transplant. Because a lot of the times early on in my health issues, I asked my sister, my family, to just say that I was a transplant.
Right.
I didn't want to specify that I was liver because there's so many connotations and things
Shame.
that come along with that. And even a lot of the people I've talked to, it's not even because of their drinking or not being able to process chemicals. It's other things like fatty liver syndrome.
Liver cancer.
Yeah, liver cancer. So but I own everything at this point. It was kind of refreshing to hear that this had happened, that she had gotten a liver transplant. I'm like, okay, great. It shouldn't have taken a celebrity to hit home like this, but it's put a lot of thoughts in my head this week.
It shouldn't take a celebrity for people to see what's going on in this particular world. Like we said, I think it's getting more and more people. You might meet someone you know now, whereas 20 years ago, maybe it was like really, really rare. But the other thing about that is sometimes we think about celebrities in terms of they can get stuff that the normal average layperson can't. But when it comes to organ transplants, that system is so locked down that it's UNOS list nationwide and everybody has to go through this process.
I belong to this hospital support group specifically for liver transplant. And it's just a community where we talk and ask questions about medications, just amongst people in the same exact situation. Like, oh, I got my transplant a year ago. Is anybody still on this medication? Or what's your activity levels? You know, it's just a place for like-minded people with the same sort of health ailments to get together and talk.
It's peer-to-peer, too. So there isn't a medical moderator or anything.
No.
It's our medical professionals. It's just peer-to-peer. So people talking about their individual experiences, much like our podcast. You know, we're talking about our individual experiences. But there's a lot of crossover, right? Because you kind of become a mini medical professional when you or someone you love goes through this, because you have to learn a lot about the medications and what's happening, and becomes your life.
Well, there is this post about this woman. So she posted that her husband had been up for like a liver transplant, and he had to go through what they call pre-testing diagnostics. Mm-hmm. For those of you that aren't terribly familiar, when you are trying to get eligibility for an organ transplant, and I believe this is for all organs, but obviously I can speak to liver, you have to go through these diagnostic testings. Like, they test your bone density, they test your dental records, they test everything to make sure that your body is healthy enough that's going to survive the surgery, and that they're not giving this precious organ, which, you know, they're not in every convenience store, to someone who is not going to thrive. And she was talking about how her husband had the dental exam and how long it was going to be after this last exam that he had done for the diagnostics that he would find out if he had qualified to get on the list.
The UNOS list. I read that same post from the same woman. And it's interesting because that brought me right back to our whirlwind getting you through. In order to quote unquote apply, which you don't actually fill anything out, but working with that doctor team to determine whether or not you get put on the UNOS list, there's a lot of variables there. And there are community members that are on the board along with medical professionals, including somebody from your team, and they state your case. In Stacy's case, she was denied twice. And we had to push for an appeal for a third hearing. And I say hearing, it's not like they're in a court of law or anything. It's a group that gets together
weekly,
sometimes multiple times in a week, but at the particular place you are. Like, so you have to be admitted to like a liver, for Stacy's case, a liver institute, a clinic where they do transplants. So you have to be a patient there. And then you have to go through a battery of testing because, like Stacy said, they want to make sure that when they put you on the list to get a liver, that your chances of success are as high as they can measure from a data perspective. And this is just data, right? So there's people that have everything on paper looking great and don't make it. And there's people who are right on the cusp and do make it. And so there's some things you can't quantify, like someone's will to fight or their kidneys bouncing back or all that. But they want to get as much information as they can before they make a decision and present it. So that's the battery of testing that she's talking about.
So at this point in me and my sister's relationship, there was trust. We had built through some experiences in and out of my hospital stays and conversations, deep conversations that we had, that we had developed a trust, especially on my side, me trusting her and her knowledge and her foresight on what was going to be the best for me. So I'm in the hospital. And I am there in the bed, and so much is going on, and my brain is cloudy, and I'm in a lot of pain.
Stacy was completely out of hepatic encephalopathy at this time. So her levels were down. So she was cognitive and clear, well, clearer, let's say, but still all the pain, and she was still hooked up to a bunch of IVs, and we had just had a really horrendous event occur. So it was my mom and my stepdad, her dad and me in the room. We had had the entire liver team in there, plus the ancillary team, which was the kidney team and others. And
I'm in this little bed there's like, you
tiny
know,
room, and it was filled with all these
felt
people.
Like 25 people came in.
Yeah. And
white
so
coats.
This was the first hospital visit that we had been to. She described in an earlier podcast about the doctor that was like, don't come back here, I won't treat you. I got her transferred from that hospital to this hospital. I knew that this was her only chance of getting on UNOS or us doing anything. If there was a chance, this was going to be the only one. And I get her there, and it's the first time I feel like we're meeting with this whole team. They come in, and they came in to tell us that they were sending her home to hospice, that she was rejected from the UNOS list, and that she should take advantage of the time that she had. And they thought that she had about 2 weeks.
They just kind of walked in. And in my brain, how I'm watching this all unfold, I've almost like separated myself to like above myself. Like, I'm looking down and I just see this like white coat mafia standing in front of me and just very matter of factly.
So I instantly go into like legal mode. What I mean by that is I started interrogating and cross-examining them, because there was one comment made during the first part of this where her now doctor, who I love so much, sat down next to me. I didn't know he was the lead of the team at the time, but he sat down next to me and put his hand on my knee, and he could see that I was amping up. And one of the comments that not him, but somebody else on his team, I believe it's a teaching hospital. So my guess is it was probably somebody that was there resident training and said, hey, you know, if she had come to us at the first time she started having any trouble, we could have given her information. If she'd come to this hospital and we had told her that she's an alcoholic, we might be able to do more. And I didn't scream and yell, but I went into literally like cross-examination mode. I was like, well, we've been to the ER and no one said that to us and we have no information. And what information do you give people when they come? And I went down this whole road and I kept saying, it's not fair that you won't present her to the UNOS team, because at that time they wouldn't present her.
Yeah, it was an open and shut.
She is not an eligible candidate. We're not going to even try. At that point, that was just it. And they did take their time and they were kind. I remember asking about palliative care. Because in my mind, I was hopeful. So palliative care comes before hospice. In palliative care, you might be able to receive some treatment. But hospice,
last stop.
That's the last stop. And it's comfort care. Thank goodness for hospice, by the way. It's an incredibly hard job. And I'm so glad that it exists. But it's a death sentence, right? I mean, it's your terminal. That's it.
Basically, I just felt like they were just sending me home to die.
Well, they were. With comfort care. But they were trying to get us to this point of acceptance. Well, at that point, my mom and my stepdad, they stopped receiving information.
Oh, they just crumbled.
So they crumbled. They were standing by her bed when all the white coats leave, all of them leave. And I'm sitting down on one side of the bed. I'm sitting down with my sister holding her hand. And my mom and my stepdad are standing over the bed. And I'm looking at them and they're crying.
And it's so hard for me to explain this to you about how surreal it is to have somebody come and tell you there's no hope. You're dying.
This is the end.
This is the end. And I felt like I was like above myself looking down on it. And I was just, I mean, I don't want to say shell-shocked because—
No,
like,
you were in shock without a doubt. Both mom and dad and you were all in shock.
And then you were holding my hand.
Yep.
And you were making eye contact.
Yep. So Stacy was not, she heard what was said, but she wasn't processing that, which is very normal. And I realized I had to explain it to her.
Because this doesn't happen to me.
It doesn't.
And this doesn't happen to anybody. I don't know anybody this happens to.
Yeah.
This is like in the movies and stuff.
It's surreal. And so I'm sitting there, I'm holding her hand, and I look up at mom and dad, and they're crying. And I looked at mom and I realized she can't say anything. And I looked at Bruce, are you going to talk to her, basically? And he was like, I can't. And so they kind of just stood there, crumbled or whatever. And Stacy looked right at me, I'm holding her hand. And she said, so they're sending me home to die. And in that moment, I realized I had to keep it together. And I did. I kept it together. A couple of tears, but even better than I am right now. I kept it together. I held her hand and I said, I knew I had to tell her the truth. And I said, yep, that's what we're going to do. And I let that sink in for a second. And
I will say this, even though we're describing this, there's a lot of silence in this moment for me. There's a lot of, and I guess that's shock, I don't know, but there's a lot of stillness and silence and just like things were hanging in the air, like around me. These words were just kind of reverberating around this small room that this was it. That's it.
And I had already talked to hospice earlier in the day. I had already started scheduling things because
Julie knew. She knew.
I did. But, I hoped not, but I was trying to prepare, right? I'm like a planner.
You are a planner.
So I wanted to not be caught off guard. But in that moment, then I'm holding her hand and I remember I gave her enough time, I felt. And then I said, but you know, if and when you decide you want to fight, you tell me. And that's what we're going to do. And it wasn't right away that she answered me. But when she did was when this whirlwind of all this testing, because now it's us as a family against all the big bad no's.
I didn't want to die. That's not what it was about. There was a lot of guilt and shame associated with me seeing what my diagnosis was doing to all of you, to mom and to dad and to you and to Ryan. What it was doing to everybody, and a small part of me kind of felt like I almost didn't deserve to fight to live and how much more I was going to put you through if I tried this and it didn't work. Or if I tried this and let's say it did, but you came to resent me. Like, these were all the things in my head. So I wanted to be very calculated and deliberate with my answer because I'm the type of person that when I make a decision, I don't turn back. I knew that if I said to you that I wanted to fight, that there was no turning back.
Yeah.
And that it wasn't going to be another situation where I was going to get your hopes up and just to you guys sit around and watch me die.
Yeah. We talk in another podcast about how I made a bunch of mistakes. One of the times that I went to the hospital thinking I was going to like fix everything in like a day or whatever. And I knew better, but I mean, my emotions took better of me. But in this moment, I had thought it through. And so I did a much better job as your sister and health advocate of making the space for the emotions to be there and also respecting her autonomy. And I remember even saying to you, I will do whatever it is you want.
And I knew she was telling the truth. Like I said, I knew she had an agenda because as someone who is a family member of someone who's hurt or someone that cares for someone that's hurt, you obviously want the best for them. You want them to live and you want them in your life. But
And selfishly, I wanted you for me.
I knew that you were going to be truthful with me and you were going to respect whatever decision I made. We had come so far in such a small amount of time.
Yeah, it was accelerated for sure.
Yeah, but we had gotten to this trust level in our sistership that I knew that whatever I said, you were going to go with.
Like, I honor it.
Yeah, honor, that's a great word. If I had said, I can't, Julie, I can't. It's too hard. It's too painful. I just want a bunch of meds to make me feel great. And I want to go home and have a shot. You probably wouldn't have given me the shot. But I'm just saying, you would have respected those wishes that I had.
You know, mom and dad were out of body.
Yeah.
And they were for a long time. They would never have accepted.
Oh, no.
If you had said, I don't want to fight. I'm at the end.
But oh, my dad with the tough love.
As a caretaker, though, the thing is it's not my body and it's not my life. It's yours. And so it's hard because I want you to be with me. And it doesn't matter why you die. I don't want you to die. I'm the older sister. I'm not supposed to have to go through that with you.
I think it's such a hard extra layer of a caretaker to detach themselves and be able to honor the wishes of the patient, of the family member, of the person that they're helping.
And I don't think you always have to detach yourself. I think it's about, I was thinking about this after our last recording, and you know, we have about a week between we record and we can be introspective and we can think about things. And I was thinking about, it's about holding space at the same time for two different things. It's about having the capacity and the tools to say, I know my feelings for Julie, the big sister, what I want, it's valid. But I also know that her feelings are also very valid and they're not always the same. And holding space for both of those things at the same time as a caretaker is really hard. And I was good, I think, eventually at holding space for her autonomy and her feelings. What I didn't do very well was acknowledge my own. And I tamped all that down.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a mistake. I'm dealing with it now. Like, I'm in therapy and I'm dealing with it now.
Four years post-transplant.
Yes, I am. 4 years post-transplant. The last year has been really intensive for me in therapy to deal with those things. But as a caretaker, sometimes I didn't have the space to do anything but her wishes and her needs. And I was also managing and mitigating damage with our parents who just didn't understand. And it's not that they didn't have the intellectual capacity to understand. They didn't have the emotional capacity to understand. And that's very reasonable. I don't want to accept that this is a truth that's happening right now. So back to the whirlwind. So the minute she said, so it wasn't that day. I think it was the next day. Am I right about that?
I put a lot of thought into it. And I know, I want to say it was later that night.
Okay, but time had passed because mom and dad weren't there. Mom and dad were gone.
It was nighttime.
Okay, so it was after visiting hours, and they never kicked me out. So I was there till whatever.
She wasn't going to let him kick her out.
Well, you know, I would have had to do what they said. But I was so good at letting them forget that I was there, right? Yeah. Like I was like hiding in the shadows or whatever. Yeah, so whatever it was, the time frame at last, I didn't push her. And at some point, really meekly, I'll never forget, it was really small, she said,
I
want to fight. And for me, that was like...
It was like I set off a sparkler in the room. Julie just came to life.
I just lit up, right? Because no matter what the outcome was going to be, it wasn't going to be worse than this.
Oh, yeah.
So no matter what was going to happen, no matter how much energy we put into trying, no matter what, forward motion, right? It was forward motion because death was going to happen either way. So now she said she wants to fight. And also, when the person decides that they are going to put all that energy into it, it changes the entire dynamic of everything. So now that meant that we had to go on this massive gauntlet of all these tests. Now, we were no, they weren't going to even bring her to the UNOS list. So finally they agreed to bring her to the UNOS list.
But I had to pass all these tests.
Well, but there was no guarantee that she was going to even get on it. And she didn't. She was denied.
Or
but we had to get permission to even go and do all these tests. So it, because they don't even want you to bother doing that if they're not going to take you to the committee.
My sister, she's like a bulldog though. She's very tenacious and she was not going to accept no. Like, what's the harm?
That's actually what my argument was a lot of the time, which is, well, while you're figuring that out, we're just going to go ahead and do this. So in order though, for me to get all these tests done, she's very sick. My sister's very sick.
Why don't you talk about my MELD score and what that means?
Okay. So they do a lot of testing to identify the health of or the function level of your kidneys and your liver, because you need all of your organs obviously to live. But when you go into multi-system failure, you know, if your kidneys are going down, you have a limited time. We can almost measure the time that a person has based on whether or not they can filter their own blood through their kidneys and their liver. And the liver
wasn't making blood to filter.
She didn't have a lot of red blood cells, or white blood cells were kind of through the roof. And then her kidneys at this point had bounced back, but what they call GFR, glomerular filtration rate, which you guys can look up, we'll put on the website a little bit about, is like a measurement. But it's not just like one number. There isn't a number that tells you, oh, she's a 9 or she's an 8. There are 3 or 4 different measurements that kind of come in this equation, right? So the MELD score is one of those equations that looks at how you're functioning of your liver, right?
And so the higher the MELD score,
the less function you have. She had at this point about 100 pounds of liquid weight that was pushing on her body and her lungs and her heart. Now, in Stacy's case, her heart was really in good condition, but with all of that weight pushing on her lungs and her heart, it's going to reduce her function. Circulation is way down. Yeah. And so they call it pitted edema. It's like you press on the skin, and if your fingers stay there, that's ascites.
I have a very cute picture, which I'll upload for you guys. I have cats. And at one point, the cat had stepped on my, I was wearing shorts, and they stepped on my leg, and it left a paw print. That was the kind of situation my skin was in, where you could press down, and it would stay. At that, well, it didn't last for long. But I mean, it lasted longer than it should have.
Yeah.
And it's a cute little paw print from my cat who ran across my lap.
That shouldn't be there for the minutes, the length of time that it was. Well, so a lot of these tests require that you have no food, no water, that you're something called NPO.
NPO.
And that means that so you can't have anything in your system because we're doing contrast. We're doing this, we're doing that. It is a gauntlet for a healthy person to go through all this testing.
Over weeks and weeks.
And I had to schedule some of these tests back to back in the same day.
My MELD score is climbing by the day.
Yeah,
she's just inching higher and higher. And to put it in perspective, I think, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the top off is like right around 40.
It is. And she was a 38 at the night that she got her liver. She was at 38 and climbing.
40 is like the point of no return. Like, we're not even going to qualify you to be on the list.
Well, once she hit 40 is when they start thinking about taking you off. So she was climbing. And I think at that time you were like, maybe you were in 32, I want to say. 28 to 32 around there somewhere, which is bad. But I had to take her from one thing to the next thing to the next thing. And it's sheer will on her part. She said she was going to fight. And man, did she show up.
Oh, God.
So I had
like one of the worst weeks of my life. And I don't completely remember all of it.
Yeah.
It's like I have flashes of sitting in waiting rooms or doing certain tests and going from this place to this place or being sticked like this and then...
And blowing veins and...
Yeah, at one point, I got sick in a waiting room.
So I'm taking her from one appointment to another appointment to another appointment. We started at, I think, 8 o'clock that morning, and she had to have a, what they call a CTPA with contrast, which is a CAT scan. So she had to get IV contrast in. But just prior to that, we had done a GI test where she had to drink this
stuff. Drink the pint glass full of chalk.
Yeah, basically. So we were going back to back. And part of this was because I was getting people to push her in. Why? Because sometimes when you make an appointment, you have to wait a month or you have to wait 2. We didn't have that time. We had 2 weeks, they said. So I had to push all this stuff into that. So anyway, here we are. We're going from one to the next. I can see her degrading.
I'm in a wheelchair. Like, I'm not even walking at this point. I probably could, but it was easier for you to wheel me around.
Well, I was thinking we have this much energy to get through this much day.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to spend it walking. We're not going to spend it.
I'm getting tired just thinking about this.
Yeah. So we finally get to the third appointment of the day, and she's been such a trooper. And I have to drive her from place to place. It's not like we're in the hospital and they're just wheeling her up and down. No, you have to go. So I drive her to the place because I had to go wherever they would fit her in. It wasn't like we had time to wait for it to be organized. And this is the thing, as her advocate in that moment, I am concerned about her, but I have to be careful because if you ask too often, what do you need? What do you need? What do you need? That becomes problematic because she's going to look at you and say, I'll tell you when I need something. And there are people.
I was prone to snappiness.
But also there's a balance there. You have to know your person, right? Everybody's different. There's people in the waiting room that are there to get this, not because they're trying to get on the UNOS list.
No.
And maybe not as sick as she is. Maybe so, but I don't want to make a judgment. They look at you. They look at you. They see how sick she is. And they
I was glowing yellow.
They make judgments. And all of a sudden, I remember her looking at me and saying, I'm going to get sick. And they had these places where you could change your clothes.
Yeah, that's like right. Little, it's like sort of around the corner.
Around
where we
the
were.
Corner, yeah. So I grab a garbage can and I could see it in her face. She didn't have to say it. I don't want to do this here. And I remember saying to her, this totally sucks, but we're going to get through it. If you want to stop and want me to reschedule this, I can. But right now, this is where we are. And I remember her looking at me and saying, no. And she got sick. And then we got her wheeled back there. But what made me angry was the way the people in the waiting room were looking at me. Like I was somehow, I don't know, I don't even know what it was, but they were uncomfortable is what they were.
Yeah.
And I get that. When you see someone that sick, it's hard. But it was somewhere between uncomfortable and judgy. And it's like, I would rather you just not make those judgments in those spaces because you don't know what people are dealing with.
And I'm dealing-
And the embarrassment.
With- So many things. I'm dealing with the embarrassment that comes along and then shame that people saw me do that or heard me do that. And then the way they look at me, some with pity, some with like, oh God, what is she even doing here? You know what I mean?
Or is she going to get me sick?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, because they don't know what's wrong with you. So they're like, oh my God, is she toxic?
Also, I don't know when you're listening to this, but this was in the year 2020. If COVID. Anyone's familiar with that. Yeah. It was a bad year for everybody. It was a very bad year for me. I received my transplant in the end of January in 2021.
We go through all of this though. And one thing that was always resounding was the minute somebody looked at her chart and we got into the place where she had to have the test done, they were always incredibly kind.
Yeah, that's true. University of Cincinnati Healthcare System is, I can never say enough good stuff about them and how amazing they were with me and how they treated me, not as another number. They were just kind and patient. This isn't a situation anyone ever expects to be in or wants to be in. So you don't practice on how to handle yourself. Your mind is in a much different place because you're trying to deal with the pain, but then you're trying to get this done. And
she was physically taxed to the limit and then some. And honestly, I was too. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep. It wasn't that I was being prevented necessarily from those things, but it was my brain. I was constantly trying to play the chess game of figuring out what to do next, which is a good time for us to bring up that your support group, whether it's family or friends or whoever, are an important part of getting on the UNOS list. It is a component.
It is.
So they want to see that you're going to have support.
It was one thing I had going for me very early. I had that going for me before I had my kidneys bounce back, before I had my fight and my stubbornness and my determination. When that white coat mafia walked in, like I said, what felt like 25 doctors, you know what they saw? They saw my sister. They saw my mother. They saw my father. They saw this group of people surrounding me with love and care and worry in their eyes. The support factor I had way early on.
Even if you're a patient that doesn't have the family that's there for you, but there are other people that will show up for you, it's important that the healthcare professionals see that. And so I knew that. So I actually had a schedule built out when she was in the hospital, anytime she, before this even came around, that they came and told us that this was the diagnosis and this was the, what they were recommending was hospice. I had already built a schedule. Every day there was someone there to visit her. I made sure that people saw them coming in and out. I did my research and I knew that the community piece was going to be a big part of it, or at least some part of it. And so I wanted to, it's almost like I'm type A and I'm a teacher, right? So if I was going to be able to get an A somewhere, it was going to be there. It was something I could control and something that I could do in that moment. So if you are a person or you know someone who's struggling, it doesn't have to be your family members. It just has to see that you have a community or at least a person that's going to assist you, because they're not likely going to score you high if you're going to be on your own. Because you need care when you get home from the hospital.
And it's not just...
And there's community organizations that'll do that
care, too. But it's also mental care.
Yeah.
Each of the people in my life, my support system, played a different part. You know, my sister was obviously my rock. She was the one that I could rely on the truth, even when it was hard. She was the one that shuffled me around to all of these diagnostic testings and stuff like that. But then... there are also a moment that I can think of where I called my dad and I knew he wasn't going to judge me. He wasn't going to yell at me. He was maybe going to make me laugh a little bit and take my mind off things. So yes, the support and more than just, I need somebody to help me get to the bathroom.
Well, it's understanding too. And it's somebody who will process with you. So it's about hope. It's about trust. It's about grace. It's about these things that you have to find a balance with. And, you know, in that moment that we were talking about at that one test, in particular, the third of the day where she was physically breaking down, she didn't have the mental capacity to even tell me whether she was going to be okay. I had to make decisions for her in that moment.
And you did. You did.
I almost cut it short. I was almost like, we got to go. But I realized we were so close.
I was so determined.
I know.
I was going to make it through. I was going to try to be the best trooper I could. But you make it through. That was a lot of my mantra repeating in my head. We'll get into this at a later time, but I am very mentally focused in the way that I like to almost trick my brain into thinking certain things. Or if I'm having pain over here, I'm going to try to do sleight of hand over there and get myself to think more about that. I have a lot of meditation practices that I'll share with you guys about how I made it through a lot of these procedures.
It reminds me of a TED Talk, actually, by Jane McGonigal. And she wrote a book called Super Better. It resonated with me during this time because she gamified her life. So she had a traumatic brain injury that put her into this concussive state for about a year. And she had the symptoms, which are rare but can happen, of suicidal ideation and just a lot of things. She couldn't get out of bed. She's a gamer and a game developer. So she gamified her life.
That's
what you're describing. And is that she would play a game with herself. Like, okay, well, I just have to make it 5 minutes and then I can do X.
That's what I do.
Exactly.
That's crazy. I want to shout out
to Jane McGonigal and Super Better, because her TED Talk is about what people that are dying say they wish they had done.
I have read articles on that, and it might be specifically
her. It's about
her.
Time.
Yeah.
And it is about
time.
Experiences and all the things that Stacey's been bringing up. It's also about that bird's eye view we're talking about and recognizing. And it's about grace for people in your life. Because in moments, we can get bickering and at each other. But if we can always just step back a little bit and look at it from the empathy, from the other person's view, not sympathy. There's another thing I'm going to throw up on the website. I'll ask our producer to toss it up there. Brené Brown does this amazing little short on the difference between empathy and sympathy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And she uses cartoon characters. And it's funny, but it really hits home. So we'll link to that on the website too for this podcast, because I think that if you haven't looked into it, there is a distinct difference between the two, but I don't know that we've all taken time to look at that. You know, our experience is unique on some level, and then there's universal themes on another. And why we're doing this so raw and honestly and trying to be vulnerable with each other is because we want to reach people. We want to say, come to our space, listen to what we have to say, and join this community, and let's talk to each other about it. Because this stuff is really hard. You know, we started this podcast by talking about how this is about hardships and sistership. And it is. And even right now, we can be put back into those spaces just talking about it. And I think then healing, another layer of healing can happen once we expose even more.
Yeah, working through it.
I got it wrong a lot, and I'm going to continue to get it wrong sometimes. But I think it's also about having space for yourself. Just because I got it wrong this time doesn't mean that I won't get it right next time. And I think that I had to learn that early on as a caregiver. I had to learn to let those things go. And this was a new situation, because if I carried any of that with me into the next thing, it was going to change the way that I showed up for her. And I wanted to show up for her with that mind towards honoring her autonomy and also doing the best that we could do together. And you have to accept that you're going to make mistakes. I made a ton of mistakes.
Yeah, it wasn't always easy, but we made it. We made it through.
We did make it through. But time isn't promised, like Stacey mentioned at the beginning. So I want to come back to this idea that we don't have to harp on it, but rejection can happen at any time. And so we do take our sister trips, and we are doing this work together because it matters. We're not promised anything else.
We're watering the flowers in the garden of our relationship.
Oh, my goodness.
We're cultivating.
Oh, okay. So on that note.
So that's what my week's been like, Julie.
That's what your week's been like?
Introspective. And yeah, this was a little rough.
It was a little rough. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been hard and also good for us to bring these things up and talk about them. I noticed, and remember how I was saying we're being a little introspective between our recordings? I noticed that I feel really validated by Stacey when I explain certain things that she hadn't thought of or didn't know.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I never thought I would ever get the chance to say them to you.
Oh, that's special.
And so it means a lot. And I feel seen by that. It's just added bonus.
Well, good.
So thank you for that.
Yeah. This was a rough one for me. I am glad we talked about some of these things, but it does take me back.
Yeah, I know. Well, until next time, we are sisters surviving and thriving. And this is Life Expectancy, a podcast about our story, hardships, and our sistership.
Bye, y'all.
See you next time.
That's a wrap for this episode of Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. If you'd like to stay close to the journey or eventually connect with others navigating similar paths, join us at life-expectancy.com. Membership is free, and we'll be opening up new ways to share, learn, and thrive together soon. Special thanks to Ryan Brunn, whose original music scores our episode with depth, and to our producer, Kenzie, who brings it all to life. And if you're a music person like us, search Life Expectancy Podcast Season 1 on Spotify, or visit the site to find our companion playlist and all of our socials. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.